Good afternoon, everyone. Hello and good afternoon. My name is Lisa Falsko, CEO of the Alaska World Affairs Council, and it's a pleasure to see everyone here on this beautiful day. Today we have a great bread basket donated by Great Harvest Bread Company, and if you have not purchased your Mother's Day's gift, you have about 2 minutes to run to the front and get a raffle ticket, and we'll have our guest speaker pick up the raffle, the winning person, in just a few moments. If you could turn off your cell phones, this program will be recorded for both the TV and for the radio. So if you could just turn off your phone or put it on silent, that would be greatly appreciated. And I'd like to thank William Toyer, who is recording today for KSKA. This program will be available if you'd like to hear it again or send it to your friends and let them know about this program or any of our past programs. All you have to do is go to alaskapublic.org and search under either the speaker's name or AWAC Presents, and you'll find this program which you can download and listen to. We are a membership organization, and memberships are expiring in June, but don't worry, if you are not currently a member, we have some great promotional offers that are happening right now. If you sign up today, your membership will be good for the rest of this year as well as all of next year. So you can get a membership form at the front, and please consider supporting the programs that we do. If this is your first Alaska World Affairs program, if you wouldn't mind raising your hand, do we have any newcomers at the program today? All right, wonderful. Thank you, thanks for coming. And if you like this program, I hope to see you at our next program, which will be on June 6th, where we're starting our ambassador series for the summer, and we'll be featuring the German ambassador to the U.S. And speaking of students, I'd like to recognize some extraordinary students. Two, I believe, are still in school taking AP tests and the like. But the three were finalists in an essay contest on Azerbaijan. They had to write an essay where they briefed Senator of State Hillary Clinton on the history and the current events of Azerbaijan. And each student was entered into a national competition from all over the U.S., and we're delighted to announce that one of the students who won the grand prize, which is a two-week trip to Azerbaijan this summer, is a student here in Anchorage. So I'd like to congratulate all three of them. We have certificates. We will bring them to them. The finalists, Curtis Sticks from West High School, Kale Klingenpiel from South High School, and I'd like to bring up our winner, Dylan Hardenberg, also from South High School. Dylan. And this says, the National High School Essay Contest, Republic of Azerbaijan, World Affairs Council certifies that Dylan Hardenberg from South High School, in recognition of achievement of his top 10 National Essay Contest winner in the national competition. Congratulations. We wish him well. And before I introduce our head table, I'd like to ask Kari to come up with our raffle tickets and ask our guest speaker to pull the winning ticket today.
What's the prize?
It is a bread basket full of a lot of goodness. Okay. The lucky number is 567795. Hey, there you go. It's going to make a mother very happy. I'd like to now introduce our head table. To my far left, we have Garrett Wong, the chairman of our board of directors. And to his right, Joe Shearhorn, CFO of Northrim Bank, the sponsor of this series. This is the final program in the six-part series of oil and gas. I'd like to bring up Joe Shearhorn to introduce our speaker.
Thanks, Lisa. Northrim Bank is very pleased to sponsor this oil and gas series that we've had here. As she indicated, this is the sixth in our series, and we've had some truly world-class speakers here to speak about a topic that's extremely important to all of us. Today, we have Edward Chow with us, And Ed is a senior fellow of energy and national security at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He brings over 30 years of oil industry experience throughout the world to us. And he's been specializing in oil and gas investments in emerging economies. He spent 20 years with Chevron, and he was the country manager for Chevron in China between 1989 and 1991. He has a breadth of experience in government, industry, and academia. He's a graduate of Ohio University, as he corrected me, in economics and international affairs. So please help me welcome Edward Chow today.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here in Alaska and in Anchorage in particular. I'm ashamed to say that after 35 years in the oil and gas patch, that this is my first trip to Alaska. For some reason, Chevron never allowed me to work in the United States. No matter how many times I volunteer to go to Hawaii and take a job there, they would always instead send me to the Niger Delta, the steppes of Kazakhstan, the secure streets of Bogota and Caracas instead. As Joe mentioned, today I continue to observe and work on the more the international side of the oil and gas arena. And I work for a independent think tank in Washington, one of the largest ones, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, which has upward of 220 independent scholars, as I said, one of the larger institutions. And we have an energy program that has a dozen people in it, which means that we are by far the largest energy program among think tanks in Washington that pretty much cover the broad sweep of the topic, both domestically and internationally. I also teach a little course at George Washington University on the geopolitics of energy around the world. So I look at energy really from a global lens, and I think about the lessons that could be drawn from the international landscape and a very rapidly changing one over the last 35 years that I've been doing this. I'm afraid to say that I don't know much about Alaska, other than this is a wonderful organization, the World Affairs Council. They contact me. Lisa told me it was last summer when you contacted me, and the wonderful series that the North Rim Bank is sponsoring. I asked Lisa, when does it stop snowing in Anchorage? And it turned out it was yesterday. So it took me a while to get here, 30-some years plus. I'm glad I'm here. And what I'd like to do is to describe a little bit of what I'm seeing in the last few years and next few years looking forward, and maybe start a conversation about how it may impact your state. Of course, you know your state and the conditions much better than I would. You know, I'm certainly not here from Washington to help you figure that out. That's there's enough of that. One of the things that we have to say is that has changed in my working career is indeed the pace of change, the very rapidity that things are happening. And change, the pace of change seems to be accelerating all the time. And it's really hard to figure out long-term what the cumulative effects are, particularly in a long-term industry like oil and gas. which, as I would describe later, is often hit by short-term volatility, but the long-term fundamentals in the industry still matters in real life. At least that's what I explained to my four-year-old grandson when I Skyped with him on his iPad. He's 4 years old, and he has an iPad that his great uncle, my foolish brother from Los Angeles, sent him. That we don't know where all this is actually leading. And the most obvious indicator of that is price volatility in the oil and gas market. Things that would have taken years, if not decades, to happen in this business in the 152-year history of the modern petroleum industry has seemingly taken a few days or hours. It's hard to remember that 10 years ago today, from today, the price of oil was below $20. 10 years ago. The price of oil had been dropping in the last few days, I think probably last 7 or 8 trading sessions. It's now just above $96 the last time I checked. Not that I do that on an hourly basis. And it has dropped from above $100 to $96 in just a matter of days. And it used to take years, if not decades, to arrive there. So, you know, from the summer of 2007, for example, to the summer of 2008, oil prices more than doubled in 12 months and hit a peak of $147.27, not that I was counting. But then within 6 months, with the financial bubble collapsing, with Lehman Brothers, within 6 months it dropped down to $32.40. I mean, this is unprecedented volatility of the sort that we've never experienced before. And what is that all going to add up to in the future is really hard to tell. In retrospect, we can say with great confidence that $147 was too high, right? Now we know. And we can also say that $32 was too low. But what is the right price? Or what is an equilibrium price? We don't know that anymore. It is in the nature of markets, particularly futures markets, to overshoot, because markets by themselves are inanimate and don't know what the equilibrium point is. It has to overshoot either on the high side or on the downside in order to seek that equilibrium again. Prices are heading down. But last year, 2011, was the highest average price in the history of the petroleum industry. People think of 2008 because we had this big spike up. But on average prices, 2011 was the highest prices in the 152-year history of the oil industry. And the cumulative effects of that we're just beginning to figure out or see even, because there's always a lag in both demand response as well as supply response to price. It's not that it doesn't respond. The elasticity is not very great in the very short run. Because in 2007, I bought that SUV, and the resale value in 2008 wasn't that great. So I'm kind of stuck with it. Capital stock takes a long time to roll over, right? If you were on equipment, on buildings, and so on, the reaction to high prices is not instantaneous. Similarly, or perhaps even more so, this price the response, the supply response to higher prices takes even longer. I mean, you all know the oil and gas industry better than most people, certainly in the lower 48. If you're lucky in this business, you make an investment 5-7 years from now, you recoup your first dollar, right? If you're really, really lucky. And you know, you have a discovery near existing infrastructure and so on and so forth. But the typical project, the mega projects, the projects that involves people betting tens of billions of dollars at a throw, takes 10-15 years to start recouping that first dollar. So high prices starting 10 years ago, we're just beginning to see the impact of that. And we still don't know where prices are going to land. I'm here to tell you, I'm here to predict that oil prices would test the $90 level in the next few weeks. If it falls below $90, there's no natural support that says that it wouldn't test the $80 level. If it were to go down to $80, it would still be higher than the summer of 2007, which is the peak of the bubble, right? So we are experiencing historically high prices, but also very volatile prices. There can easily be a $20 political risk premium on prices today. Last year it was Libya, right? This year is Iran. What is the uncertainty premium? What is the role of speculation in the futures market? Yesterday we saw the headline that JP Morgan, a bank that was supposed to be pretty well managed, and in theory, Jamie Dimon's reputation is not as good today as it was before. How do you lose more than $2 billion in hedge fund trading in a period of 6 months? No, 6 weeks, actually. I'm sorry, 6 weeks. And there may be another billion to go. People say that futures trading speculation has very little to do with oil prices. And I'm here to dispute that. Because if we believe that speculation in foreign currency pricing has something to do with the value of foreign currency, why doesn't that work with oil? Market psychology is just driving the futures market now. The futures market is no longer driven so much by fundamental supply and demand, but by sentiment. And people are speculating on sentiment as opposed to be speculating on supply and demand. It's no longer strictly a hedging phenomenon. So it's hard to know where all of this is heading, except that we do know that there's a lot of uncertainty, that much for sure. The other thing that we've learned in the last few years, I submit to you, is the peak oil theory is bunk. Right? Turns out that $100 oil, you will invest a lot more money to extract from resources you have previously discovered, and you would also spend more money exploring for oil and gas in places that you passed over before because it was, geologically speaking, much more speculative. So with sustained high oil prices in the last, say, 5 years, we're now seeing discoveries in places that we never thought contain much oil and gas. Who knew we were going to find a significant oil field in Uganda? No one would have guessed that a few years ago. Or offshore Mozambique, world-class gas discovery offshore Mozambique. Eastern Mediterranean gas. Who could have imagined that a few years ago? Offshore Israel, world-class discoveries. which ruined the best joke about the oil and gas in the Middle East I had ever heard, actually. The joke goes along the way that God made Moses wander in the desert for 40 years, and then he arrived at the only place in the Middle East that doesn't have any oil and gas. You know, obviously Moses didn't explore long enough and didn't have the benefit of $100 oil, otherwise he may have found something. So it turns out that the amount of oil and gas available to be produced is restricted more by our imagination, by our ability to innovate technologically, by the amount of investment people are willing to risk, more so than by geology. By conventional wisdom, the world has produced about 1 trillion barrels of oil so far, and most geologists that I know believe that there's another 1 to 2 trillion barrels left of conventional oil to be discovered, never mind unconventional sources. I love the term unconventional because it has taken on all kinds of meaning, particularly in the lower 48, people like to talk about as if it is some kind of radical, revolutionary, technological leap. Well, you know, conventional oil used to be, you know, you drill a hole, you have this blowout, and you discovered, oh, there's some oil and gas here. And it was all natural flow at one time, right? And then we discovered pumps. And then we discover water flooding and other secondary recovery methods. And then we discovered that we can inject special chemicals, heat, and so on, and we move into more and more tertiary recovery methods as the price of oil goes up and justify it. So shale gas revolution, fracking, is just another of a series of technological innovation this industry has had. So we call that unconventional today. 20 years from now, we might call that fracking conventional, right? So what is the definition of conventional? Turns out that as oil prices go up, you start doing interesting things in deep water Brazil. In the pre-salt, where the drilling is very difficult, but with high oil prices, you can economically justify taking that risk. Turns out that you can do a lot more with oil sands in Canada with high oil prices. With oil prices below $50, economics don't look so good. But at $80, $90, you can have a good go at it. So it is really above ground conditions, maybe, that limits our ability. Washington making right decisions on pipelines, for example. Then it is geology by itself that limits our ability to produce more oil and gas. And as I already referred to, the shale gas revolution is by far the best demonstration of that. If you had told me 5-7 years ago that the United States would be producing more gas than Russia, I would have thought you were crazy. No way, right? We're the most drilled real estate in the world. We've poked more holes, particularly in the lower 48s, than any other real estate in the world, and we're tapped out, we thought, right? But the past 3 years, the United States has produced more gas, than Russia. 10, 15 years ago, we were talking about our country needing to import liquefied natural gas. Terminals were being sited and projects proposed all around the country on importing more liquefied natural gas. And now we're talking about exporting LNG within a very short period of time. We used to think that whole shale gas revolution was driven by high gas prices, and it was. $13 gas, right? We can do all kinds of interesting things, George Mitchell and others, at $13 gas. And then we started doing it, and we thought, well, they need at least $4 or $5 gas for using these exotic techniques to make it economic. Well, we learn how to do it better, right? We continue to improve and drive down the cost so that now, what's the price of gas in the lower 48? $2. From a $13 peak to $2 or even below. So a country that was going to import a lot of gas will be exporting some volume of gas. No, we don't know how much. But the mere fact that we're no longer anticipated to import gas from places like Qatar and elsewhere has changed almost entirely the North Atlantic LNG market. Because all that extra gas is now flowing into Western Europe rather than to the United States. Why? Well, because that same $2-3 gas in the lower 48 is worth $8-10 per million BTU in Europe. Well, I can figure out how to make money there, right? Even I can do that. It's worth $16-18 per million BTU in Japan. No, we will get to what does that mean to Alaska towards the end. But that pricing difference means that, and the fact that the United States will be starting to export gas to the rest of the world means that what had been previously regional gas markets may be linked up more and more, assuming the transportation economics of larger and larger LNG tankers will connect the world. Now, the Japanese situation is partly masked by Fukushima and the fact that 50-some nuclear reactors in Japan are currently shut down. We don't know what the long-term impact of that is going to be. But nevertheless, if there is such a premium that for LNG in Northeast Asia, someone is going to capture it, whether that's Alaska or someone else. So a gas market is going to, over time, with more and more LNG cargoes, with a spot market developing not only here in the United States but around the world, with gas-on-gas competition rather than gas that's price indexed against oil, we will see a gas market in the next 10, 15 years that will start to look a lot more like the globally connected oil markets than it is today. So what does that mean to the United States, and what does that mean in terms of what people like to talk about, energy security, energy independence, and so on? I'm not as optimistic as some of what you may be hearing out of Washington, including a couple of your previous speakers who I happen to know well, also from Washington. Because I think we need to be realistic about the scale of the challenge we have in the United States, particularly when it comes to oil. 70%, more or less, of the product barrel in the United States is connected with transportation fuel, motor gasoline, diesel, jet. We have 4% of the world's population. We consume more than 20% of the world's oil. To think about the scale of that, 40%, around 40% of the gasoline that's refined in the world every day are consumed on American roads. We have a disproportionate reliance on liquid fuels, on oil, particularly when it comes to transportation. So it may be that the United States won't have an energy supply insecurity problem because we have plenty of domestic coal, we have plenty of hydro and nuclear, we're now become self-sufficient net exporters, perhaps in gas, but it's oil where the vulnerability is. And we can't solve that problem unless we find a substitute for oil for transportation fuel, or start conserving a lot more than we have, and what are the means of doing that. The example that I like to use to illustrate the scale of what we're talking about is the Macondo spill, with due respect to colleagues from BP who may be in the audience. The Macondo spill was a terrible disaster. 4.9 million barrels over a number of months onto the sea in the Gulf of Mexico. 4.9 million barrels. For those of you everyone in Alaska, I'm sure, knows how much is a barrel, but a barrel is 42 gallons, right? So newspaper people like to quote gallons, oil people like to talk about barrels. Newspaper people talk about spills in gallons and production in barrels, because that makes their point better. But 4.9 million barrels is the equivalent of 6 hours of U.S. consumption every day. I mean, think of the scale that we are talking about. So doing this is not going to be done in one day, or as the Obama administration thought, in 2-3 years. Transforming the energy economy, given the scale that we're talking about globally and in the United States, would take at least 2-3 decades, not 2-3 years. In spite of the best efforts of my cousin, Stephen Chu, that was a joke. He's really not my cousin. Stephen Chu, the Secretary of Energy. When the administration first came in, I used to say that to foreign audiences, and everyone took me seriously, which meant that I was treated really well when I went to Azerbaijan. That transformation doesn't mean that we don't need to get started. If anything, the fact that it's going to take so long should give more urgency towards getting started, but it's not going to happen quickly. And in order to do this, we need a national dialogue about the challenges that's involved. A honest national dialogue, one that is not marked only by slogans. And I don't really care what the slogan is. Energy independence, New Gingrich's $2.50 gasoline, Obama's green jobs, everyone will be working in green jobs soon. Drill, baby, drill, which maybe have a special resonance here. None of these are sufficient to get, in a democracy, a public to understand the challenges involved. In order to do that, we need brave politicians who are willing to invest political capital to talk about these issues in a serious way, which I guess, coming from Washington, makes me very pessimistic. How do you sustain the scale of what we're talking about? The world moves 89 million barrels per day today, about that, just short of that. Can we continue to increase the level of consumption at the rate that we are doing? And we're not talking about geology, we're talking about political risks, we're talking about moving all this oil and gas around the world. We're talking about political uncertainty, that most of the incremental supply comes from the Persian Gulf through the Straits of Hormuz. How sustainable is this? And I haven't even mentioned climate change, right? And these are real issues that will take a long time for us to face up to the challenge, as I said, and seek the right solutions. In order to do that, politicians have to be willing to talk about it in a serious way, because if they don't talk about it in a campaign, and I wrote an op-ed piece a couple 6 years ago about this, that we're not willing to talk about it during a presidential campaign, then what mandate that whoever is elected has to do anything if you don't talk about it in a democracy? You never ran on it, how are you going to do anything about it with the people's support? This is a huge problem that we have yet to face, honestly, in my mind. What does this all mean to Alaska? Well, you tell me. We've got a long-term industry, and this industry has been in the state for quite a long time, with all these short-term volatility. Certainly, it needs requires an attractive investment climate. And I understand there was a rather contentious legislative session recently. I came from Juneau, so everything I learned in the last 24 hours. but probably even more important than attractive investment terms is the stability of the investment conditions. That in a long-term business, you have to be able to count on the same conditions for a fairly long period of time, otherwise the risks are too high. And of course, the industry looks at opportunity costs. $10 billion in Alaska versus $10 billion in Brazil or Russia or somewhere else. Of course, we have certain advantages in this country, including the rule of law, which means on a risk-adjusted basis, you can probably tax the oil companies a little bit more than they do with the Russians, right? Because you have to discount a lot on the Russians. But not so much with Alaskans, who are more dependable, even though you can see Alaska from here. see Russia from here. But having stable conditions is really very, very important, because you need to sustain the investment conditions on things like a pipeline that might take many years to materialize, even if you start tomorrow. I read your governor's op-ed piece in today's paper where he claims that Alaskans are nimble. I don't know how true that is, but I'm here to tell you that you will need to be nimble in order to seize the opportunities provided by the export market for gas in Asia, because you're not the only ones going after it. There are enough projects in Australia that's already not only on the drawing board, but being implemented right now, that soon, in another few years, Australia will be exporting more LNG than Qatar. Those world-class discoveries offshore Eastern Africa will go into the LNG market. China is talking about consuming more gas, but they're also talking about producing more gas, including experimenting with shale gas production in China. I'm not as optimistic as some people in Washington that the shale gas technology could be easily transferred around the world, mainly because the above ground conditions, even if the below ground conditions, the geology is similar in Poland, they don't have the advantages we have in many ways, and we can get into the details of this in Q&A if you would like. But I'm here to tell you that if it can be replicated internationally, the shale gas revolution, the Chinese would do it. They are already buying into place in North America, and they are buying and learning how to do things as they go. So there's a window of opportunity for Alaskan gas, perhaps in Asia, but it is not an infinitely wide window of opportunity, and you need to move quickly in order to seize that opportunity. Of course, stranded gas in the North Slope, it's been stranded as long as I have been in the oil and gas business, right? 30 years, we've been talking about bringing Alaskan gas to the lower 48. The lower 48 no longer needs it, nor can you afford it to send it to them if price of gas is $2-3 per million BTU. It's in the international market that you need to look at the opportunities. And I hope the governor is right, that Alaska is nimble and that you'll be looking more and more across the Pacific. One of the things I discovered that Alaska needs to do, just in the last few days, is probably be more connected to the rest of the world, particularly to Asia. I tried to find a flight from here to Asia recently when I knew I was coming here. I might need to go to the Philippines afterwards, and I discovered that the only way of getting across the Pacific is through Hawaii. Not that I object, but I fly from Washington to Tokyo all the time. I mean, probably six times a year I fly from Washington to Tokyo, and I fly over Alaska when I do this. And I think if you're not connected with the rest of the world, then you will become flyover country. And that's not where you want to be. If the booming markets are across the Pacific from you, surely you must be able to see that. You can see Russia. And I think this is where the function of an organization like the World Affairs Council that believes in a informed public, including on matters international, is so important. When I was living and working in San Francisco for more than a dozen years, I used to be a member of the World Affairs Council of Northern California. And Lisa didn't ask me to say this, but do join, do continue to participate in not only a national dialogue about energy, but also an international dialogue. And I'm happy to be here and hope to continue in the next half an hour in a conversation with you about what little I know and learn more about the concerns of your state and how it interacts with the rest of the world. Thank you very much for your attention.
Well, Mr. Chow, thank you for your great comments, and we're going to invite you back to the podium for questions in just a minute. But for those of you in the audience who would like to ask questions, please wait for the microphone to reach you, because we are, again, recording this for both television and radio. And on behalf of the board of the World Affairs Council, Mr. Chow, we'd like to give you just a small gift, reminding you of your fine visit to Anchorage, Alaska, and we hope you come back soon.
I hope so, too. Thank you.
All right. And again, a reminder, we have on June 6th, Peter Amann, German ambassador, who is going to speak about the challenges for German foreign policy in 2012. So please RSVP to our website if you'd like to attend that. And Lisa, did I forget anything else? Well, again, thank you for joining us today, and I'm going to invite Mr. Chow back up to the podium to answer questions that you might have about his speaking on oil and gas.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chow. Given your long tenure for Chevron in China, can you give us some perspective on, A, Chinese, what percent of China's oil do they produce themselves, and what are their prospects for the future? And specifically for me, because I visited there, what are the prospects for the Dacheng oil field?
Oh man, I'm sure in Dacheng, when I was living in China, in Dacheng, they were producing more water than oil. So I imagine that it's producing even more water than oil today than when I was there quite a number of years ago now. Dacheng, for those of you who don't know, is the largest oil field in China. Dacheng means, in Chinese, big celebration. The field was discovered on the 10th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China, which is why it's called Dacheng. China has now become more import dependent on a percentage basis than the United States. It consumes about 8 million barrels per day or so. I mean, think about that. China, with a population that is four times larger than ours, consume less than half of the oil we consume. And of course, they're growing at 8-10% a year. We're growing, if we're lucky, at couple of percentage points a year. So they import about, in round numbers, 4.5 million barrels per day today, and they consume about 8. So they're more import dependent than we are at this point. A lot of commentators and forecasters say that China, which is today the second largest oil importer in the world after us, will pass us and become the largest oil importer in the world. I'm not sure I'm going to see that. Maybe that will happen. It assumes that China will continue to grow at the rate that it has. 30 years of 10% in round numbers economic growth, hard to argue against. But if you can have growth indefinitely, trees would reach up to the skies, right? There are natural limits to it. I mean, what the Chinese have experienced is economic reform, opening to the world, releasing this pent-up economic engine that are the Chinese people. But the Chinese people are getting older. We're going through a demographic bulge in the post-Mao period that we're going through now, and their population will age just as we have seen the population of Europe age, just as we've seen the population of Japan age. Growth will slow down. They will be looking at more and more internal consumption for more services than goods. So I'm not sure that that's going to happen continue to happen in the next 20, 30 years as the last 30 years has. It would also assume that we get a lot smarter, as I said earlier, about our use of oil, that we become a lot more efficient, I would submit to you. So if both things happen, Chinese continue to grow, U.S. continue to improve our efficiency, maybe those two lines would cross and they will exceed us as the largest oil importer in the world. But both things have to happen. The country to watch for, if you're not looking beyond the next 10 years, is India, which will have a greater population than China, has hundreds of millions of people who don't have regular access to electricity, right? There's more than 1 billion people in the world who don't have regular access to electricity. A lot of those people live in South Asia. As the Indian economies grow, their call on energy will become greater and greater, including their call on the international supply of oil and gas. So the story, the next 10 years may still be China, but 20, 30 years from now, the story might be India rather than China. And it'll be interesting to watch since the Indians are at the beginning of the takeoff economically, and China may be already be halfway in the takeoff stage of capitalism and economic development. But the big thing to watch for is actually India. So.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chow. Just wondering if anyone in the usual oil think tank is thinking about the thoughts that come out of climatology think tanks, and if so, what do they think? And I guess I'll reference that concept to a recent editorial that was in the New York Times that used the catchy phrase about if the tar sands are developed, that it's game over for climate change. So maybe if you could comment on that a little bit, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Gee, I hadn't read the editorial, but that's pretty stark. It may be game over then, because the oil sands will be developed. Whether we consume it or the Chinese consume it, the oil sands will be developed. I mean, I think we need to face the reality of that. I'm not a climate change expert, as maybe you can tell by now. I believe that there are political and supply constraints that will limit our ability to continue to consume more oil and gas around the world, fossil fuels. So there will be other reasons besides climate change, which is no doubt a legitimate concern to worry about. The question is, what do you then do about it? You know, how do you arrive at a sort of global agreement on climate change? And then we get back to China in a minute. The United States and China together emits something in the order of around half of the world's total greenhouse gas emissions. So if the United States and China were to get together and do something about climate change, it would go a long, long way. And, the Europeans like to think that they lead, but I'm not sure who's following. You know, they think they're leading, but no one's following, which is kind of a problem if you want to be a leader. So I think it's really important for us to get together with the Chinese. And the way to talk to the Chinese about greenhouse gas emissions is to not talk to the Chinese about greenhouse gas emissions. Why? There's kind of a Chinese story to explain greenhouse gas negotiations with the West. The way the Chinese explain it to me is as if the West inviting China, India, South Africa, Brazil, countries like that, to join in a banquet. Only the West have already eaten the first 10 courses of that banquet and are only inviting the emerging economies whose carbon emissions are much lower on a per capita basis than ours. And if you believe in climate change, it's the cumulative effect of the 300 years of industrialization that leads to the problems with climate change. And that's the first 10 courses, right? So it is as if we invited the Chinese to dessert after the 10-course meal, and they only had dessert, and now we say to them, well, let's split the bill. And they say, well, wait a minute. You got the benefit of the first 10 courses. That's not fair. So if you want us to do something about climate change, tell us what you're going to do for us, right? What are you going to give us in terms of technology transfer or other benefits to make it worthwhile for us to limit our greenhouse gas emissions? Then it becomes a very difficult negotiations. The way the Chinese are going to tackle greenhouse gas emissions is not about greenhouse gas emissions, but because of the environmental concerns, the same ones we had in the 60s and 70s, which is SOx, NOx, particulates in the air, water pollution, all of those things that affect daily people's lives, right? The way I imagine it is every time a Chinese kid coughs, we have four grandparents looking at the kid and say, what's wrong? Now the air is bad, the government's got to do something about the air being bad because those four grandparents only have one grandchild, right? And to fuss over. And so it is the kind of daily average person's concerns that would cause the Chinese to do something about greenhouse gas emissions. We help them with the traditional environmental concerns of sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, particulates, and so on. The result will be a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. But that wouldn't be necessarily be the reason they would do it, because if you tell them that the greenhouse gas emissions is that, you know, then they'll say, well, give us the fruits of your last 10 courses you ate before we arrived at the table. So that's a very, very difficult negotiations. I don't know that the oil company think tanks, if they still exist. When I joined Chevron, we had a 40-man more men than women, unfortunately, at the time, economics department. That economics department was charged with looking at the global environment that the company was going to be operating in. Those kind of economics departments, by and large, don't exist anymore in big oil companies. There are very few big oil companies to do their research on their own anymore on that kind of policy issues. ExxonMobil does that somewhat. BP does that. But they are the exception rather than the rule nowadays. A lot of that kind of thinking is outsourced and done by people like think tanks like my own or commercial services. So I think the oil companies have been behind the eighth ball on the climate change issue, and they need to get ahead of the curve. But I'm not too optimistic that they're going to get there really fast. The public can't wait for them. The public needs these issues addressed in an intelligent, informed way, whether the oil companies are ready for it or not.
In a world where, if I understand you right, there will continue to be volatility in the price of oil, therefore, volatility in the reaction of the public, going for years in which the Prius is the favorite cars to years in which the largest SUV you can buy is the favorite car. Is there not a role for somehow or other stabilizing this such that people are incentivized to conserve? And I'm thinking in particular of an idea that was very much in favor in the early Clinton years of a gasoline tax. And is there any hope?
I promise you I didn't plant that question. but I'm all in favor of a gasoline tax, and I've written on it. And I'm all in favor of a really robust gasoline tax. For one thing, we haven't increased federal gasoline taxes for 20-some years. So we haven't even kept up with inflation. If you don't believe it, just drive around the roads in the lower 48 for a while, and you'll know that we haven't maintained the federal highway system as well as we should have. But the real reason that I believe that a robust gasoline tax, and I'm thinking 50 cents, a dollar, or higher, but at a minimum 50 cents, is that I believe in a market economy, the price signal, it should be the guide of consumer and producer behavior, more than the government regulating or mandating performance, as we are currently doing. You recall that after the 70s and 80s, we mandated higher CAFE standards, what's called CAFE standards, corporate automobile fuel efficiency standards. But when the prices went back down, people didn't want to drive those cars anymore. So we and the auto industry conspired together to create a new category of passenger cars called light trucks, right? That didn't have to conform to the mileage standards of passenger cars. Those light trucks became SUVs. For a number of years, light trucks and SUV sales exceeded passenger car sales. So we wanted heavier cars, larger cars that had higher performance, and the automobile industry helped us get around the fuel efficiency standards that we place on ourselves because we didn't let price lead, we mandated performance instead. We're doing that again, and that can work to a certain extent. But I really think that a robust gasoline tax is in many ways the answer, because as I said earlier, our vulnerability is oil import dependency. It's not about gas, it's not about electricity, it's really about oil used for transportation fuel. There are good arguments against that. The argument against that I relate to is that gasoline tax is a regressive tax. And of course, you don't want to hurt the working poor, because as long as we don't have a good public transportation system in this country, the working poor needs to suffer greater pain to get to work than maybe the rest of us do, because we can afford it a little bit better. Well, the way to solve that is to rebate to the working poor. And we have a mechanism for doing that. It's called the Social Security tax, which is also a very regressive tax, the payroll tax. And as a result of the president's stimulus program, we are all already enjoying a lower payroll tax withholding than we were before. So we have the mechanisms to rebate to the working poor if we want to, and not just subsidize the entire economy, subsidize middle, upper middle class people with a low gasoline price at the same time. There is surplus economic rent to be extracted from today's crude oil price. We know that because, as I said, prices at the highest level ever. The problem is right now the extra economic rent is captured by the producers, by Saudi Arabia, by Russia, by Venezuela, and not by ourselves. Why not capture the extra economic rent by taxing ourselves and putting that tax revenue to good use, whether it's narrowing the federal deficit, narrowing any concerns about the soundness of Social Security, Medicare, and so on, and achieve a public policy objective at the same time. The other thing to point out, going back to the question about climate change and greenhouse gas emissions, is that if you did something about restricting or moderating passenger car consumption of gasoline, that's about a third of the problem in our country on greenhouse gas emissions, slightly over a third of the problem. Another 40% is power stations. So if you tackle both electricity generation, power plants, and those are much easier to regulate because they are large, by definition, large facilities, and automobiles, that's 75%, 80% of the greenhouse gas emission problem that we have in this country, which goes a long ways to achieving the objective without, you know, checking every dry cleaner, every bakery, which sometimes people talk like they want to do when they start talking about carbon taxes and other things, where we don't even know how to collect those taxes when we have a good mechanism for collecting gasoline tax. The mechanism already exists. You don't need to invent a new federal bureaucracy machinery to do that. And we also know how to rebate part of that tax to the working poor to help the people who really need the help. So, yes, you and I are all in favor of a robust gasoline tax, which is probably why neither one of us would be elected anytime soon. I mean, that's the problem. And that requires a voting public that demands of the politician honest talk rather than the kind of wishful thinking or sloganeering that I talked about earlier.
Over here. Sir, thank you for your presentation. It's very enlightening. Can you tell us if you know of any oil province where raising taxes has increased the investment in production?
I'm not suggesting that increasing taxes will increase production. I'm suggesting that increasing taxes on the consumption of energy will moderate the growth of the consumption of energy. What kind of tax policy should be in place in order to encourage investment in the production of the menu of energy sources that we would like to have? That's quite a separate discussion altogether, and I know this is quite a topical issue here in Alaska. I was addressing the gentleman's question about gasoline tax.
Well, my point is, do you know of any province in the world where raising taxes has increased production?
If you want less of something, you tax the heck out of it. If you want more of something, you tax it less. So it depends on the kind of behavior you want to encourage. If you want people to invest more in production, then you should give them more incentive for that investment. I don't have any argument against that.
Thank you, Mr. Chong. Hey, I appreciate your observation about the need for the nation to have a robust, realistic, and slogan-free discussion about the energy future. We've seen in Alaska how there's challenges in political systems making realistic discussions possible. Given the current two-year and four-year political timelines, are the U.S. political systems up to the challenge of meeting the future energy demands? And if not, what suggestions would you have? Is there any place in the world that does have the political structures to address these problems appropriately?
The question is a good one. It's a bit beyond my competence. I'm not a political science person, certainly not in domestic politics of the United States. So I don't have a good answer to your question. I do think that an informed public ought to demand a different level of discourse from their elected officials than we're currently getting. And how you get that, I don't know whether there are sort of systemic changes that can be made in the political system, whether it's term limits or something else, that may lead to a different kind of representatives. I don't really know. However, the way I look at it is that I'm in a think tank. And in the think tank, my contention is we may not have all the answers, but we ought to at least raise the right questions. The questions that need to be addressed in the global commons and as well as in the body politic in the United States. And so this is why I go around the country saying unpopular things, raising uncomfortable questions, because I think they need to be addressed, but not by people in think tanks. But by the people's elected representatives, and we should at least call them to question, at a minimum. If we don't, and there have been plenty of times, in my mind, where the policy community in Washington has failed even to raise the right questions, never mind provide the right answers, then we have really failed. And I can think of a couple of foreign policy debacles we've had in the last 10 years where the policy community, including think tanks, Congress, media, did not even bother to ask the relevant questions. So I think of my job as raising, making sure that doesn't happen again, that if we are going to wander foolishly into an unsustainable path, at least some of us are raising the alarm bell and saying that, what about this, what about that, how do you address it? But I'm sorry, I don't have a good answer to your question. I made fun of Europe and didn't mean to do that, actually, but it was so easy. But for some reason, the European public, which does not believe its own governments on issues like genetically engineered food material, for example, believe in their government about climate change and seem genuinely concerned about the global effects of climate change. Now, partly because they are so import dependent. That may be part of it, but that's can't be the only thing there. They are doing something right, at least in raising the public consciousness of some of these issues, and we're not doing that, and I cannot explain to you as democracies why they're better at some things, certainly not all things, than we are, but maybe there's something to be learned from them.
I was wondering if you, on that large transportation usage, if you knew the split between use for individuals versus distribution of goods, trucking industry.
Overwhelmingly, the individual passenger car. Now, the president talks about, in the not the last State of the Union address, but the State of the Union address before that, about putting 1 million electric cars on the road. Sounds like a really ambitious, glorious target. 1 million cars, electric cars. You know how many registered passenger vehicles are in the United States? 240 million. What's 1 million electric vehicles? I think if Americans can figure out a way of driving more than one car per individual at the same time, we would do have done it. You know, it's really remarkable, and which is why I think you know this is probably not the most favorable ground to discuss this great state with great distances where you all rely on, planes, boats, and automobiles to get around your great distances. But some of us who live in Washington and elsewhere, for example, we need to start thinking about the density that we live, the American ideal of, half an acre and a lot of yard for the kids to roam around in, which is my daughter's dream right now with two grandkids, but living very far away from where you work is unsustainable in the long run. So you see young people in the lower 48 moving back into the cities. Now, there are a lot of things that need to happen in order to sustain that. The young people moving there now don't have kids. Well, city schools need to be a lot better to retain families in the cities. We need transportation systems that we don't currently have. Europe has a much different population density, so urban transit makes a lot more sense for them than for us. So there are a lot of things that have to change. Why do we need to drive to the office every day? I don't. I work in a think tank, so all I do is think. And I can do that pretty well at home, in spite of what my wife would tell you. So with telephones, emails, Skype, I can communicate around the world, and I do, to anybody I want. I do need to see people. Face-to-face meetings in this communication revolution, I think, has become even more important. So it's really good that you're going to Azerbaijan, okay? Because you don't get a feel for that country or its people unless you see them in the natural environment face-to-face. So there's no substitution for face-to-face meetings, but I don't need to do that 5 days a week. So I go to my think tank couple of days a week when I'm in town, when I'm not in Azerbaijan. But they communicate with me. Is there any reason why we all need to sustain the lifestyle, given the other advantages that we have on that the communication revolution has given us. They say, well, Americans like mobility, which is true. It's part of our spirit as a country. I like mobility. I like to be able to drive into open spaces. But I don't need to do that every day. I don't need to do that as part of my daily commute. Skype can give me mobility. Because how else can I talk to my friend in Geneva just like that? Right? Because I can't. No, it takes me time to fly over there and schedule, carve out the time and so on. So there are different ways of organizing work, the different ways of organizing living, of organizing education that we're beginning to take advantage of. And with gasoline prices, we're at $8. Because the federal government just took a lot of that in taxes, that would concentrate our minds a lot faster than if it were at, you know, $4.20, which is what I saw on the street earlier today.
My name is Ray Finn. I know the time is very long, so I have a very short question. It's about Japanese government shut down the older nuclear power station, and they try to import more coal from the worldwide. So that may create more the pollution, and also maybe will create more downsized economic in Asia. What do you think about the government, Japanese government, shut down the nuclear power station there?
It's probably unsustainable. But the Japanese problem is that Fukushima was a real disaster, and will be remembered for a long, long time. Much more so, I would submit to you, that Chernobyl or Three Mile Island, because it is a major impact. They also have permitting practical problems on how to reactivate the reactors. It requires local permission as well, and the government hasn't figured out a way of doing it. We've also have constant changes in government in Japan. Japan has almost had as many governments in the last 5 years as Italy, which tells you something. There've been a new Japanese cabinet just about every year. I mean, seriously. So it's really hard to make tough policy choices in those circumstances. But the nuclear power was the only more or less non-imported energy source that Japan has. I believe it will come back in time, but how quickly and so on. They're not only importing more coal, but also oil and LNG in replacement. The only good thing that has happened in Japan since Fukushima that I can tell, and I've been there maybe three times since Fukushima, is that Japanese no longer wear ties when they go to work, which I think is a vast improvement. So, for a button-up society and salarymen coming out of the metro station and you go to offices, you have meetings with ministers, none of them are wearing ties because you can therefore raise the temperature in the summertime in office buildings with the peak electricity season in Japan being the summer rather than winter. That's a real lifestyle change. So you can it's a small anecdotal indication of where people, if they're willing, can change, and not just in a symbolic way, but in a substantive way at all. But I believe that some amount of nuclear will be coming back in Japan, whether it is 3 years from now or whenever. I cannot predict, but it will be coming back.
Thank you so much for an excellent presentation.
Thank you.
You mentioned early in your presentation that we're trading more on sentiment than on fundamentals, that perhaps the cost fundamentals of oil production, depending on type, mm-hmm. is down around 50 or 60 bucks than right. 120 or something. So if that price, so in such a sentiment, the price is bound to be volatile. So somehow we need to get, if it's excessive speculation or whatever, that market's not given an honest signal to oil company investors. Thus, even if oil prices in Japan stay tied to oil, which that might be a guess too, we can't believe that gas price, you know, important to Alaska because everybody talks about, oh, there's this hot mm-hmm. market in Japan and we're going to invest $40 billion to make a pipeline. Well, after you deduct out the cost of that pipeline alone, the gas at the North Slope is worth next to nothing or perhaps less than nothing. So I guess my question is really about federal policy. Is it pretty much a foregone conclusion that one that applied for export license would get it? I see they've given them to turn these import facilities around, which are kind of an emergency because otherwise the guy's going to lose his billion-dollar investment. So do you know anything about the policy? Is there that discussion taking place at the federal level?
There is. Technically, what needs to happen when we export gas through a non-free trade country, which means a country that we don't have a free trade agreement with, which, by the way, Japan falls into that category, is that the Department of Energy needs to make a determination that this would be in the national interest and don't distort domestic markets. So Cheniere now has that permission from the Department of Energy, and they're the first of the export projects to likely to go ahead. So DOE would examine these applications on a case-by-case basis. My guess is that they would do it cautiously in order not to have a spike in domestic gas prices, which would not be good for domestic industry or good for any government politically. But whether it's going to be limited to a handful of projects or more, we don't know at this stage. But the process is for DOE to make the determination, which is comes back to the question of how nimble Alaska is. If there is a limited window, as some of us think there is a limited window, can Alaska be nimble enough to seize the opportunity and step into that window, or would it just take too long? Permitting on the pipeline, on liquefaction facilities, and so on. I take your point on the financial risks that the state should not be bearing. In a free market system, I believe it is the investor that ought to bear the risk rather than the state, which get back to the gentleman's question earlier about how do you provide the conditions, the incentives, not to not tax them, but to tax them less than otherwise in order to for them to want to take the financial risk. But the state should not on its own be taking financial risks of the sort of conversation that I've heard before some years ago, such as giving producers a gas price floor that the state would guarantee. That would mean the state taking commodity risk, price risk, which I would not be in favor of, because that's the people's money, and let the risk takers do that. But what are the optimal investment conditions to allow good projects to go forward? This is what you elect your public official your public officials for. I don't know whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, but that's what they're there for. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Chow, thank you for joining us today. And again, we invite all of you to join us at our June 6th meeting with the German ambassador. And that's all for today. Thanks for joining us. Great talk.
Yeah, thank you.
Very, very.